and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
We're funding a system, not for tomorrow, not for next year, but for decades to come.
Lawmakers working on transit and state budget challenges. Plus, a physician-assisted suicide bill made its way to the Illinois House. Why some are sounding the alarm.
I've spent my career standing up to bullies.
And Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy joins us to discuss his bid for the U.S. Senate. And now to some of today's top stories. As the Chicago Board of Education meets this evening to consider renewing charters for 16 schools, the Chicago Teachers Union is calling for more oversight of charter schools.
We're here to fight for more protections for families and students and educators when charter operators want to close a school. We're here demanding more accountability, oversight, and support so that charter schools serve all students well, including our students with special needs and students who need additional English language services.
The union points to the distress they say families experienced last year when Acero Charter Schools closed half of its campuses last year. The union argues charter companies have gotten away with not providing sufficient support for students in special education and English language learners, over-disciplining black students, and have an out-of-school suspension rate 5 to 7% higher than public schools. Teachers say they support a measure before the Board of Education tonight that would address some improvements to the board's charter authorization and renewal process. A bill requiring public libraries to keep opioid overdose reversing drugs on hand is heading to the governor's desk. The Senate passed House Bill 1910, proposed by an Elgin High School student, to also keep at least one staff member on shift at all times who is trained in administering Narcan or naloxone. Chicago public libraries already have a similar program where anyone can administer the drugs instead of only a trained library staffer. The bill's sponsor, Democratic Representative Anna Moeller from Elgin, says she's optimistic the governor will sign the bill. And we'll have more on the latest from the last days of the Springfield session in just a minute. Neighbors on the west side of the city will notice some road closures this weekend for the fourth annual Bank of America Chicago Half Marathon. The 13.1-mile race on Sunday starts and ends at Garfield Park, taking runners through Douglas and Humboldt Parks via Independence, Douglas, Franklin, and Sacramento Boulevards, which means some street closures in the area have already started and will continue through Sunday. To find out how those might affect your driving or your bus route, please visit our website. Up next, the latest live from Springfield, right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Lawmakers are finally out with proposals to fund reforms to Chicago area public transit. The plan aims to fill a $770 million budget gap that could shut down CTA, Metra, and PACE services. It's one of the many fiscal challenges that still need to be ironed out with the state budget deadline just 2 days away. Our Nick Blumberg joins us now live from Springfield. Nick, what kind of funding streams might we see, and will it do enough to keep transit from going over that fiscal cliff?
Well, short answer, Brandis, if these revenue measures pass, yes. Of course, that's still an if. Now, the sponsor of this, State Senator Ram Villivallam, he has been one of the lawmakers leading the charge on the transit issue. He said the numbers are still estimates, but that the current revenue proposal would do enough to meet that $770 million budget gap, and the estimates expected to exceed that, although it would probably fall short of the $1.5 billion benchmark that some lawmakers and transit advocates had been hoping for. Now, there's a lot in this revenue proposal. Let's get into some of the highlights. There's a fee on public electric vehicle charging stations, a 50-cent surcharge on tolls, but no more than a buck per car per day. It directs a portion of the interest earned on the state's road fund toward transit. And there are rideshare fees and real estate transfer taxes in suburban Cook County and the Collar Counties as well. Now, Villivallam held a press availability this morning to discuss this revenue proposal. Here's a little bit of what he said.
Now is the time to break through the status quo, provide safe, reliable, accessible, integrated, environmentally conscious, and economically impactful public transit to the region and embrace a viable long-term solution.
And Nick, we know the Senate Transportation Committee discussed this bill earlier today. What did we hear?
That's right. There were quite a few lawmakers and transit advocates who were very excited, both about the governance changes, which still need to be finalized. There are a couple different, slightly different versions right now, as well as some of these reform proposals. But of course, this is Springfield, so not everybody's happy. Let's hear a little of the testimony.
We strongly oppose any transit governance reform legislation that lacks a dedicated and sustainable revenue source. Restructuring oversight without addressing funding issues is both irresponsible and counterproductive.
This bill in the form before us today doesn't fix transit. Instead, it takes away the ability for county and local governments to provide services.
Now, Mark Paulus, who we heard from first there, he represents a major union with workers in construction and other related industries. They work on things like roads and bridges, which, of course, are funded by the road fund and tollway money. He says toll surcharges for transit are the wrong way to go, as is that interest on the road fund, which we should say at last check has a balance of some $3.7 billion. Now, as for Jennifer Bertino-Tarrant, she and other Collar County executives, they're upset in particular because right now, a portion of the sales tax that the RTA collects, it goes towards those Collar counties. This revenue proposal would put it all toward transit. Now, for his part, Billy Bollum says he has worked hard to come up with a compromise deal that everybody can agree on and that gets transit money, it's the money that it sorely needs. He pushed back very forcefully on the notion that this was somehow a takeover or a bailout for Chicago. He said this is his best attempt to achieve a world-class transit system. Well, enough colleagues of his agree. We'll know soon.
So, Nick, where do things stand with the budget now?
That's right. Last we heard, budgeteers are still inching toward a deal. They've got to find a way to pay for everything. And as we heard yesterday, Governor Pritzker says he's not interested in what he calls broad-based taxes. But we heard earlier from one of those budgeteers, Representative Cam Buckner. He sounded confident that they'll meet the deadline and find something that both lawmakers and the governor can agree on. There's also been increasing talk that lawmakers might be coming back this summer to address potential federal funding cuts. But as for this session, the May deadline is creeping up quickly. One staffer warned this morning to expect a very long day. And Brandis, you have to imagine that's going to be true tomorrow and Saturday as well.
Sure it is. Nick Bumberg in Springfield for us. Thank you, Nick. Up next, one-on-one with Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy about his bid for the U.S. Senate. Stay with us. A heated race is already unfolding to replace longtime U.S. Senator Dick Durbin in next year's primary elections. Since the 80-year-old senator announced his retirement last month, three Democratic candidates have launched campaigns. That includes two members of Congress, Robin Kelly and Raja Krishnamoorthy, and Illinois Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. We've recently spoke with both Stratton and Kelly about their campaigns. Here now to discuss his candidacy for the U.S. Senate is Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, a Democrat from Schaumburg who represents the 8th Congressional District. Welcome in. Good to see you in person.
Hey, thank you, Brandis. Same here.
Thank you. So, as we said, you've represented the 8th Congressional District since 2017, covering portions of DuPage, Kane, and Cook counties. This also includes the 41st Ward of Chicago. Why do you want this job? How do you intend to serve the people of Illinois differently or better in the Senate than you have served your district in Congress so far?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. You know, my family and I have been privileged to live the American dream. I was born in India. I came here when I was 3 months old, and things were going well until suddenly my father lost his income. But thanks to the generosity of the American people and public housing and food stamps, we were able to get back on our feet and then ultimately make it into the middle class in Peoria, Illinois. And my father said, you know, whatever you do, make sure this country is there for the next families who need it. That's become my North Star, my mission statement in Congress. Now, Senator Durbin, who's been a champion of the underdog for decades, people like my family, for instance, and now that he has decided to announce his retirement, I thought, well, this is my duty to try to be there for the next families who need it, be a champion for underdogs who are seeking the American dream at a time when it's under threat by Donald Trump and the economic chaos of the moment. I've made a career of standing up to bullies, and now I have to stand up to the biggest bully of them all.
The race got competitive quickly.
Yeah.
As we mentioned, Lieutenant Governor Stratton, Representative Kelly also in the running. How do you plan on setting yourself apart from your fellow Democrats during this primary?
I like both of them. I work closely with them. I think there are two differences. One is, as I said before, I've made a career of standing up to bullies from my perch in Congress, whether it's going after e-cigarette companies who've preyed on our youth, trying to hook them onto vapes, or Purdue Pharmaceuticals, who has tried to hook a generation of people onto OxyContin, or food conglomerates that go after, unfortunately, our families by tainting baby food with toxic heavy metals. I've gone after them, held them accountable, and now I need to do the same with regard to this Trump administration. The other kind of difference is, I think that the American dream, as I said right now, is under threat. People want to realize their full economic potential. And having been a small business person, and now in Congress, having worked on issues of economic mobility, upward mobility, such as authoring the law that enables 11 million people each year to get a higher quality skills-based education. That's extremely important for the 60% of Americans without a four-year college degree. And so these are the economic pain points that people are feeling right now. How do I make it in America? How do I achieve a better economic station in life? And that's kind of been at the center of my work, both within and outside, within Congress and before Congress.
It sounds like you've laid out, you know, some of your priorities being particularly economic. Do you think that, you know, these are the issues that the race is going to come down to?
I think so. I think everywhere I go, people are very upset about their economic station in life. I'll just give you an example. This morning I was in Rockford at a family-owned business with 25 employees. Because of the horrible tariff policies of this administration, imposing blanket tariffs on products from around the world, this company of 25, which was going gangbusters as recently as last year, is now laying off people. And so I had a chance to speak with the owner as well as the employees. And, you know, basically what we need is stable economic policy that allows for the growth of small businesses in Illinois and in other places. And that's among the various challenges people are facing right now.
You have mentioned that you've spent your whole life standing up to bullies and have opposed President Trump's, a lot of the actions by his administration, most recently calling President Trump's student visa freeze and his social media vetting proposal of those students both, quote, discriminatory and a strategic blunder. You yourself are, of course, a Harvard Law graduate. Why do you think the president is going after universities and international students this way?
Well, I think with regard to international students specifically, he's going after Chinese origin students. Now, let's be clear. Anybody who would seek to do us harm in this country, whether they are affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party or any other entity, should not belong here. However, he's not just going after them. He's going after people of Chinese origin who may be seeking a student visa and come from Hong Kong, where they were persecuted by the very entity that's our adversary. And I think the reason he's going after these people is he's trying to distract us from the fundamental economic problems that beset Americans. He doesn't want to talk about the fact that this quote-unquote big, beautiful bill, which I call a large, lousy law, is going to strip 8 to 10 million Americans of their health care. Or the food stamps that help my family survive are being cut to the tune of $200 to $300 billion.
If elected, you'd not only, you'd be the only second Indian American ever elected to the U.S. Senate. Of course, the first was former Vice President Kamala Harris. What does that mean to you?
Well, it's a big deal. There's an old saying in Washington, D.C., if you don't have a seat at the table, you're on the menu. And I think that this community, the South Asian community, feels like they need to pull up the proverbial seat to the proverbial table now, especially with rising anti-South Asian, rising sentiment against minorities of all kinds. And as an, you know, a racial, religious, ethnic minority with 29 letters in my name, I am that stereotypical person who maybe Donald Trump doesn't want to see in the U.S. Senate, but who belongs there on behalf of all of those who might have been otherized, whether you're a minority, LGBTQ member, a woman, or anyone else.
Before we let you go, so far you have outraised your fellow candidates in this race with a $19 million campaign fund. Representative Kelly having $2 million. The Lieutenant Governor's PAC has not reported what she's bringing in yet, but obviously we'll find that out as the race continues. How do you plan on keeping that up?
Well, I'm just so blessed with thousands of donors who are willing to chip in whatever they can because of the central mission of our campaign and my office, which is make sure this country is there for the next families who need it. Make sure everyone has access to the American dream. And so I think that vision for our office now and maybe hopefully in the future as a U.S. senator will continue to propel our resources forward.
And I bring that up just because there has been some question raised about your relationship, ties to your feelings about Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India, and whether or not any of your fundraising is tied to his supporters.
No. I think that the issue is this, which is I oppose discrimination of any kind against anyone, anywhere, whether it's in India or whether it's here. I was the first member of Congress to arrive at O'Hare International Airport to help free a couple dozen Muslim green card holders during Muslim Ban 1.0. I think that this kind of insinuation by some that somehow I have dual loyalties is personally offensive, but that's something that has been litigated in past campaigns, and the voters found it to be a silly charge.
Okay. Congressman Roger Krishnamoorthy, candidate for U.S. Senate. Best of luck on the campaign trail.
Thank you so much.
Of course. Up next, debate over a new bill in Springfield about physician-assisted suicide. As Illinois lawmakers consider a bill that would allow terminally ill adults to end their lives with medical assistance, those opposed to what's commonly known as physician-assisted suicide are sounding the alarm. They warn the proposal could deepen health disparities and put the lives of poor, disabled, and incarcerated Illinoisans at risk. Meanwhile, advocates of the measure say it gives individuals already dying more control over how their life ends. Joining us are Sebastian Knowles, policy analyst with Access Living, a group that supports Chicagoans with disabilities. And on Zoom, Tiffany Johnson, an end-of-life doula and founder of We Too Shall Pass. Thanks to you both for joining us to talk about this. So yesterday, an Illinois House committee voted in favor of pushing this bill forward. Of course, if it passes the House, if that should happen, it would still have to go through the Senate. Tiffany Johnson, I actually want to start with you. Why do you think the state needs this legislation?
Thank you so much for having me. I have personal experience as well as profound experience within my end-of-life doula work, which formally began in 2018, but I have had the great privilege of witnessing all kinds of death and dying experiences for folks. So through that experience, through my own father's dying and through my father-in-law's experience, who was in the state of Illinois, diagnosed with a terminal brain cancer, wishing for an option to end the pain and suffering he was going through, did not have that access. It became personal for me at that moment. And we have this available in other states. I don't see why Illinoisans should be unable to access.
All right.
So this option.
Okay. Thank you, Tiffany. You froze for just a second there, but we've got you. Sebastian, as a disability justice advocate, what are your concerns that you have with this kind of legislation for the disabled community?
Definitely. So I first want to start off and ground us in the conversation, and I'm sure that we can all agree that our healthcare system, quite frankly, is broken. That 82% of physicians believe that people with disabilities have a lower quality of life. And there's multiple studies that have gone and proven this. But we know through the COVID-19 pandemic that there were plenty of individuals and plenty of policies across hospitals across the entirety of the United States that had policies in place that prioritized ventilators for people who do not have disabilities and instead did not give those ventilators to people with disabilities. Again, this is the devaluation of disabled lives. So there's this component. But there's also the idea that our healthcare system, again, it's fundamentally broken, but we are on the verge of a healthcare crisis where we are seeing that hundreds of thousands of Illinois residents are at risk of losing their Medicaid coverage, that 30,000 plus undocumented immigrants are at risk of losing their Medicaid coverage through state cuts, and then as well as 30,000 plus individuals within Illinois Department of Corrections have no access to end-of-life options whatsoever.
From reading some of the research and the writings that Access Living has done on this, it sounds like you all believe, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding it, that the healthcare system should take care of the living better, and fewer of them would be in a position to, they'd live longer. They would have better, healthier lives, and would not need a position of, I'm so ill that I am now terminal.
I look at this as, and I'm sure that people at home that are watching this can relate to it, that this idea sounds appealing because there are healthcare companies that, in this bill, they are the ones that ultimately have a choice, right? That individuals who are losing their Medicaid coverage, that they are a single mother of four, and their child is diabetic, and they have an inability to access insulin, that those individuals, right, this is their only choice if they are no longer able to get insulin for their child, right? And insurance providers now have the choice through this bill language, right? There is no protections in place for those who are non-terminal patients, that plans can be altered, benefits can be denied, and if life-extending treatments can be denied for non-terminal patients, right, those diseases in and themselves become terminal. So we want to prioritize increasing the amount of independent living supports that folks have, increasing the access to end-of-life care, and then improving the quality of that end-of-life care as well.
Tiffany.
Yeah, so I absolutely am on the same page about quality of end-of-life care. I have a deep appreciation that, you know, this topic is challenging and for all folks, because we all have mortality, right? We are all facing this end. This bill is not accessible. The insurance companies do not have the say. Actually, that part is incorrect, because folks who have a terminal diagnosis that is determined by two independently vetted doctors who have determined that person has 6 months or less to live, only that individual who has that terminal diagnosis decides for themselves. The bill gives them the dignity and the autonomy to have that choice to access a compassionate and dignified end and support in medication that they only self-ingest. There is no coercion from family members, insurance companies, anything along those lines. That is very deeply built into the bill, because I personally, as someone who advocates for folks who are dying on a regular basis from my work, it does not matter to me what I want or think is right or wrong, right? My whole goal is to give people the option and what works best for them, and then present those options and help support them through those wishes.
Okay, almost out of time. Tiffany, 11 other states and D.C. have passed similar legislation allowing life-ending treatment. What do we know about those models and how they're working?
They're so far working very well. We're almost entering on October 27th, 28 years that this has been available in the United States, beginning in Oregon. Yes, correct. And it's recently passed in Delaware. We have several other states coming up. We just want to join the legions of options available to Illinoisans. Already 70% of
have, Sebastian, what's your... Sorry, we've just got about 20 seconds. Sebastian, what's your impression of how this works in states where it is legal?
I will just say this, is that there is only one state where there is an accessible option to actually file a claim against a provider for coercion. That there are three other states that note which agency is in charge of investigating these cases. But in this bill language, there is no agency charged with investigating coercion. In this language, there is no agency in charge of oversight and compliance.
That oversight is lacking in this proposed bill.
There's no coercion if we can't actually report it.
All right. We'll have to leave it there and keep an eye on. Okay. We'll have to leave it there and keep an eye on this legislation. My thanks to Sebastian Knowles and Tiffany Johnson. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
And that is our show for this Thursday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 for the Week in Review. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.